Welcome. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls Media Roundtable. After months of living under a strict lockdown, the world's longest, millions of Italians began leaving their homes on Monday. Today's guest, journalist Eric Reguli, reports that caution is still the dominant theme for fear of a second wave of COVID-19 infections, which some epidemiologists think is inevitable as the restrictions in Italy and other European countries are lifted. Italy is one of the epicenters of the pandemic. It has 215,858 COVID cases, and tragically, almost 30,000 people have died. These numbers are according to Johns Hopkins. Joining us to talk about the latest is Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Eric is based in Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Hi, Rose. Great to be back.
Well, Eric, it's great to hear from you. The last time we spoke, you all were just starting your lockdown, and we've been following you on Twitter. How are you and your loved ones doing?
Better this week, Rose. We've been in lockdown going into our ninth week now, and the lockdown in Italy was much tighter than North America or Britain. We had very little freedom. It was actually a criminal offense to leave the house. Unless you were shopping for food or medicines, or you had to go to the hospital and die, of course. So nothing much else. So it was hard. As a journalist, I didn't mind too much because, I was at the epicenter of the world's biggest story and I was flat out. But it was weird because I couldn't see the story. I could just sort of report on it from my little domestic prison. This week, the restrictions are off a bit, but you can't say the quarantine's finished. I can go bike riding. I can go to a cafe, but not sit in a cafe. It's only for takeout only. Restaurants are still closed.
And Eric, overall, what has really struck you about media coverage of this in Italy? Because here in the United States, the Trump administration is really trying to change the frame, and we can talk about this later, but they're going from, still, this is a major health crisis. Nurses protested this week wanting to raise awareness about nurses that have died, sadly, and yet the Trump administration's really focusing on opening the economy. What is it like in Italy?
Entirely. There was huge media and public support for what the Italian government was doing. In fact, to the popularity ratings of Giuseppe Conte, who's our prime minister, and who was a complete unknown 2 years ago. He's a Florentine lawyer, not a politician. They've soared. They're up, 70-80%, which is unheard of in this country because, yes, they made a mistake early on. They closed down too late. But once they closed down, they made it tight and hard and admitted their mistakes. So the media supported them. Business supported them. The public supported them. But now you can see the media, the right-wing media especially. The newspapers and the TV stations in Italy are very political. They go from the extreme populist right to communist, and the center right and the right leaning press now is starting to gang up on the government for opening up too slowly, and that really concerns me because if anything, I think they're opening up a bit too quickly.
What are you hearing from epidemiologists about what could potentially happen if things open up too quickly in Italy?
Well, I haven't heard of an epidemiologist yet who is not predicting a second wave. And to be fair to Italy, the numbers are coming way down. The number of deaths is a quarter of their peak in March. Daily new infections, and today it was 1,300. It was 4,000 or 5,000 at its daily peak in March. So it's way down. But Rose, you got to remember that when China lifted the quarantines in Wuhan and the other cities that had been quarantined, they only did so when the new infection rate went to zero or close to it. you know, in Italy, we're still getting, you know, between 1,000 and 1,500 new positives every day. That's far from zero. So the worry is there's going to be a second explosion of cases. Now, from a personal point of view, this week, you know, I've been going out every day with my notepad and camera and watching people. And the Italians aren't respecting social distancing very much this week. They were last week. This week, it's like, oh, the pandemic's gone. Well, let's go out and walk in the sun and have fun. It's not. It's this could end very, very badly.
Are you all required to wear masks when you're out and about?
No, you're not. Though most Italians do, I would say. Though I mean, they're sloppy about it. I mean, it's funny. The older Italians, you know, the ones who have the greatest risk of dying, wear their masks and gloves. The younger people, not so much. Or they're wearing the masks around their chins, or they're not covering their noses. Okay, by and large, yes, but I'd say a significant minority are not. And as we know, with so many asymptomatic cases, you know, anyone can be infectious now. There's still no testing, mass testing in Italy. That's the other problem. There's not enough masks. There's no tracing app yet. They're developing one. And they've done a lot of tests, I think 2.5 million, but that's still a very small percentage of the population. We have 60 million people here.
Mm. You report, Eric, that the northern Italian region of Lombardy, the capital of which is Milan, remains the worst problem area. It's responsible for half the deaths and more than a third of the new cases. So it's still a problem in the north. What is happening in the south?
Well, that's a good question. It really, Rose, it really is a tale of two countries here. The epidemic started in northern Italy around Milan, and it's intense there. So we've had 30,000 deaths. Almost precisely half are in Lombardy, which is Milan, the industrial heartland, the commercial center, you know, Prada, fashion, you know, that sort of stuff. Anything south of Rome has not been hit very hard at all. For example, in Basilicata, there's been 26 deaths versus 15,000 in Lombardy. Basilicata's in the deep south. Even Rome's not been hit that badly. This raises an interesting political question. The southern governors, so anyone Rome down south, is going, why can't we reopen before the north? I mean, why is this a national decree? Why are you imposing the same opening laws or restrictions on us that you are in up north in Milan? And I, you know, I'm sympathetic to that argument because in the south, where unemployment is 20%, youth unemployment is 40 to 50%, there's virtually no industry. It's a service economy. I think they should be able to open before the hard-hit areas in the north, and that's the debate going on now. The southern governors are getting mutinous.
Can we talk a little bit about how this has affected people? You wrote a piece about millions of Italians returning to work on Monday with a mixture of relief and fear. And you quote Michael Fortuniti. He's 36. He owns a small bistro in central Rome. He has one child. His wife is pregnant. The rent on their property is about $2,300 a month. He's not sure his business is going to survive. He says that the state gave him 600 euros in March, but he hasn't seen 1 euro since then. How common is that?
Oh, it's everywhere. I mean, this is the first of all, you got to realize that Italy was virtually broke before it went into the COVID-19 crisis. It's much worse now. It's in the worst recession since World War II, maybe the worst recession in peacetime. The GDP is going to fall probably by 10%. So that's a consensus figure. It's probably more than that. So you have these, Italy is small and medium-sized entrepreneurs. It's not like the United States where you have huge, huge companies and chain stores. There's not a lot of that here, even though it's a G7 economy. It's a very big economy. It's a G7 country. But the problem is there's very little state support. So, like, this kid I talked to, who owns a bar around the corner from me, he's had, in 3 months, he's had 600 euros. And he's still got to pay the rent at home, and he's still got to pay the rent in his business. The other problem, Rose, is that all the offices, we live right in the United Nations area here, all the offices are still closed, and most of these big offices, for example, the UN building right next to me has 3,500 employees in it. They're all going back to work with 40 employees, 4-0, and they don't expect to go up to more than 500 by the end of the year. So, I mean, look at all that traffic, you know, all these rich UN employees who like to go out for lunch. That's dead. That's gone. So there's going to be, even in the high, formerly high traffic areas of Rome and these other big cities, there's going to be a mass amount of bankruptcies. It's a huge crisis. I actually don't know whether Italy can stay in the euro.
Really?
Yeah. There's a very scary poll, Rose. I'm just looking. I was looking at this before I came on air here. So the support for the EU and the euro is plummeting in Italy. It was never that high, but it was always a majority. So the latest figure has support for the EU down to 42%. 2 years ago, 42% of Italians want to leave the euro now. Only 26% want to leave the euro in 2018. So the non-support for the EU has doubled in 2 years. Well, why is that? Well, when Italy went into crisis in late February, when it started locking down, it appealed for help from the rest of Europe. They needed doctors, money, PPE, masks, all that sort of stuff. And Europe just extended its middle finger to Italy and said no. So guess what Italy had to do? It had to go to Cuba for help, Russia, China. There were convoys of Russian trucks on Italian streets. And this is incredible, delivering equipment. The EU apologized and made the mistake, but the Italians feel they're utterly abandoned by the EU at their time of greatest need.
What explains that, Eric?
Well, another good question. My own theory is there was never much unity. As soon as this crisis hit, it was every country for itself. Now, Italy was doubly annoyed because, you remember, you know, not long ago, there was a refugee crisis here, and Italy again said, we need help. You know, it said that we, Italy and Greece, can't be responsible for all the migrants from North Africa. And I was totally sympathetic for that because the law said that the country where they land is that government is responsible for taking care of the migrants. I don't think Italians are anti-migrant, but they had no money to take care of them, and the rest of Europe was supposed to take their share of the migrants. They didn't. They just left them bottled up in Italy and Greece. So there's resentment going into the COVID crisis. Now it's redoubled. Now, the third thing that we haven't talked about is can Italy even afford to stay in the euro? And I don't know if it can. You know, it's got a lot of debt here. The debt to GDP is 135%. It could go to 180%. It just can't afford to fix its economy. So maybe it will have to take the lira back and devalue it.
Today we're speaking with Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. Eric is based in Rome, Italy, and after months of living under a strict lockdown, one of the world's longest, they're going into their ninth week, millions of Italians began leaving their homes on Monday. Italy is one of the epicenters. Tragically, almost 30,000 people have died, according to Johns Hopkins. If you'd like to join us, if you have any questions about what's happening in Italy and Europe, if you have any family or friends there and you have some stories that you'd like to share, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. as is the case with really every country, caution is still the dominant theme for fear of a second wave of COVID-19 infections. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org or tweet at yourcallradio. Eric, you brought up a lot there. Going back to the small businesses, that, you know, there's so many tourists flock to Italy. And I wonder if many of them know about the high unemployment numbers and the economic problems in the country. Of course, you don't see that when you're, you know, just walking the beautiful streets and sitting at a beautiful cafe. What is the government doing to help these small businesses?
Well, not a lot, because this government's virtually broke. It has rolled out a support package to pay employees who've lost their jobs. It's worth about 25 billion euros, which is 26 or 7 billion U.S. dollars. It sounds like a lot, but again, it's a big country. It's a G7 country, 60 million people. It's not really a lot. If you compare that to Germany, which is the dominant economy in Europe, they're rolling out a package worth $500 billion. I mean, it's not double Italy. It's, you know, like 20, 30 times what Italy can afford. So Italy's at a huge disadvantage here. It can't afford to do a lot. Now, what Giuseppe Conte, the Italian prime minister, wants is common bonds. You know, Italy doesn't have its own currency. It uses the euro, so there's the European Central Bank. What Italy wants is a common bond. So this bond would be backed by all the governments, the 19 governments in Europe that use the euro. Why is that an advantage? Because if it's backed by the good credit of Germany, Netherlands, you know, the rich northern countries, this common bond could be sold at a very low interest rate, in almost free money. And then Italy and Spain and Greece, you know, the poorer countries, could use this cheap money to repair their economy. The problem is that Germany, this goes back to what you asked me before, why is support for the EU falling in Italy? Germany has nixed the idea. The Netherlands has nixed this idea of a common bond. France wants it, Spain wants it, Greece wants it, and Italy wants it. And to me, what is going to make or break Europe in the next while, 6 months or a year, is how Emmanuel Macron, the president of France, which way he sides. Do they got to decide to side with Germany and cast Southern Europe adrift, or he's got to lay down the law and sides with Italy and Spain and Greece and say, look, we need these damn common bonds, or else the whole EU is going to blow up.
Hmm. Can you talk a little bit more about how the EU has moved when it comes to, you talked a little bit about Germany. What about Spain? Because they're starting to also relax their very strict restrictions.
Yeah, well, Spain's in a similar situation. They've actually been hit harder than Italy. The number of total coronavirus cases is higher than Italy's. Their death rate's a little bit lower, but it's getting close. It's more of a service economy than Italy is. It's much less industrial. So, you know, there are a lot of jobs in Spain, more jobs in Spain that can't be done from your home than in Italy. But it's having problems too. I mean, it's in very, very deep recession. It really needs, it got clobbered in the last recession in 2008, 2009, 2010. It was just absolutely destroyed in Spain. Though it came out of it pretty well. It came out of better than Italy, but they're back in it. And so they want these common bonds called Corona bonds as well. And I don't know, because I haven't seen the figures, but I imagine there's a lot of frustration in Spain right now that Germany is playing hardball and saying, look, we're not going to give you what you want on this common debt.
Today we are speaking with Eric Reguli, European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail. He is based in Rome. If you have any questions for Eric, or if you've heard of anything that stands out for you from family or friends in Europe, We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. Let's go to David in San Francisco. Hi, David. Welcome to the show. Hi, do we have David?
I'm here. Yeah, hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay, good. Yeah. Hi, Rose. I'm. You're probably aware that San Francisco has done extraordinarily well in this epidemic, that our death count as of today is 31 people. It's not thousands. It's not hundreds per day. It's totaling 31 as of right now. And so the solid reason that we got that way was because we just shut down the economy. And I'm wondering, Europe has got, famous Christian tradition, whether it's the Dark Ages or the Enlightenment. And I'm wondering if, we've got the problem of the people trying to turn on the economy, and that's going to hustle things up and stir up the epidemic. Has Europe got enough of a tradition that they can shut down the economy long enough to shut down the epidemic?
Thank you. Eric?
Good question. Thank you, David. Look, there have been shutdowns before, but, the last extensive one was World War II, and even then, the economy wasn't entirely shut down. It was shut down in the cities that were bombed, like Milan, but never in Rome, which was, not bombed a lot. Of course, we've had, bubonic plagues in the medieval era, but there's not enough money in this country to look, the Italians aren't rich. There's a lot of rich people in Italy, but generally they're poorer than Americans. There's not a lot of reserves. So, Italians do have to get back to work. And the debate in Italy is whether Italy should go to the Sweden model. The Sweden model, in Sweden, they never locked down. They did social distancing, but everything was kept open. And it's too early to say whether it's worked. Their fatality rate is much higher than other Scandinavian countries, but, it's not extremely high. It's not off the charts like Italy is or Spain. So that's the debate going on now. Can Italy afford to stay shut much longer? No, it can't. But, how many people do you want to kill here to reopen more quickly?
And Eric, how are low-income people living in poverty, people on the streets, how are they surviving in Italy? I mean, here in the United States, as you know, there are mile-long lines for food banks.
Food is being distributed. I mean, no one really goes hungry in Italy. There's a lot of food around. The interesting story, Rose, is in the south the problem in Italy, here it is about, I'm making this figure up, but it's ballpark accurate. It's about something like 10 to 20% of workers in this Italy are in what they call in nero, in black, which means the underground economy. They don't get any benefits. They don't pay any taxes. It's a cash economy. They can't get benefits at all. They can't get these, these jobless payments. So they are struggling, especially in the south. What's happening there is the mafia is now distributing food to them free. Now, the mafia, will expect a favor down the road, but this is a godsend for the mafia, this crisis in the south, because they are feeding the people who can't feed themselves. They're not asking for anything in return now, but, at the next election, they'll say, look, we gave you free food last year. We want you to vote for our candidate in this election. Or, give us your restaurants, which would be used for money laundering, or your bar, which would be used for money laundering, or your farm, that sort of thing. But that's what's happening in the South, which is very, very ugly.
Wow. What is the relationship like between the mafia and the government?
Well, it's officially they're at war. The Italian government's done a very good job of lopping off the heads of the Cosa Nostra in Sicily. I mean, there's four mafias in Italy.
and they've pretty much dismantled the godfathers in Sicily. But the mafias are very strong in other parts of Italy and in Europe, throughout Europe, and the Camorra, which is Naples. But my point is, the mafia loves crises like this. They know how to exploit them. This is how they started, a century and a half ago, by exploiting a crisis, by offering protection and food in exchange for favors down the road, and it became the most successful criminal organization in world history. That's still very much the case.
Eric, before we let you go, what are you working on right now?
I just finished a fun little story on how Ferrari reopened. I don't know how much time you have, but the one-sentence version is they got wind of this pandemic in January because they had employees traveling from China back to Italy, and they said, watch out, we better get ready for this. And they actually started stockpiling face masks in January, which is like 2 months before anyone else started doing this. Very successful reopening. They're back in full production this week.
Well, we will look for that story. Thank you so much for joining us, Eric, and we're glad that you and your family are doing well.
Thank you, Rose. Nice talking to you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you. Eric Reguli is European Bureau Chief for the Globe and Mail, joining us from Rome, Italy, and you can find his reporting at yourcallradio.org. Coming up after a short break, award-winning journalist Jared Posner will join us to talk about big pharma lobbying during the pandemic. We will also talk about the case of Dr. Rick Bright, a former high-ranking U.S. scientist who filed a whistleblower complaint accusing the Trump administration of wrongdoing. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. We'll be back after this. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about big pharma lobbying during the pandemic and the case of Dr. Rick Bright, a former high-ranking scientist who filed a whistleblower complaint accusing the Trump administration of wrongdoing and funding potentially dangerous drugs by those with political connections. Dr. Bright, on a call with reporters after filing his complaint, said, quote, "I was pressured to let politics and cronyism drive decisions over the opinions of the best scientists we have in government." Well, joining us to talk about media coverage of these issues is Jared Posner, an award-winning journalist and New York Times bestselling author of several books, including his latest, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and the Poisoning of America. Hi, Jared. Welcome back to the show. Thanks for joining us.
Rose, great to be back with you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you, Jared. Since you're in one of the epicenters, how are you and your loved ones doing?
We're doing well, physically at least, although I continue to marvel here in Florida as a state, that Florida reports numbers that vary widely day by day, sometimes up, sometimes down. They're nowhere near the 14 days in a row down, but they're also basically counting testing from hospitals. They aren't counting testing from private institutions, which are doing about 90% of the testing. They don't have the capacity for it yet, so the numbers are just a guess in this state, and that's not very comforting.
So give us an update about what is happening in Florida. We were just reading a piece from Click Orlando, and the headline is, Florida should not reopen without more testing, some lawmakers urge DeSantis.
Yeah, I mean, this is the great question, I think, that's being faced here in Florida and in other states that are moving quicker toward reopening, which is, what happens if you don't have the testing in place? You can't make the judgments. It's not just a question. I mean, people in public service should understand, and politicians should understand, if you can't judge where the potential hot spots are, where a super spreader could be, if you can't say that inside of Miami there's a particular district or even a building that all of a sudden has a high infection rate and move quickly to be able to limit its spread and containment, you're going to have widespread community spread. And the issue here is one that's right in our face because, as a matter of fact, I live two blocks away from a public park that was reopened last week by Miami Beach. They reopened parks with the sort of the rule that said you have to wear a face mask and social distancing within the park. That was flouted. Several thousand verbal warnings were given. People were told to leave the park. And in the end, it was so out of control that the city went back to closing the park. So if we can't get it right, even in terms of working with one another as citizens, trying to be careful that even if we feel healthy and are young and don't think that the virus will affect us, that we might have it and give it to somebody who's older or more vulnerable, or somebody who's sick or a frontline responder. If we can't get that right, and the government can't get the testing right, it doesn't give you a lot of confidence to think that opening things up is going to be a big rousing success. And I don't like the idea to think that our political leaders are crossing their fingers and then saying, let's see what happens.
Let's talk about where we are right now. More than 1.2 million people have been infected with COVID in the United States. Tragically, more than 75,000 people have died. We could hit the 100,000 mark in the coming weeks. And Gerald, I mean, the coronavirus has dominated the news cycle for the past 3 months, but the coverage has changed in recent weeks. There's a focus on scientists warning of a possible second wave hitting the country if states open too soon. Scientists are also testifying, saying not one state is ready to reopen. At the same time, you've got the Trump administration and Republicans across the country attempting to change the narrative by talking about the need to open the economy. And yes, we know that so many people are struggling to pay their bills, but these states are implementing a patchwork of plans to open businesses. What are your thoughts about how the media are dealing with these kind of two stories that are happening right now?
Yeah, I think that the media has started to be a bit more critical, which is good. For a while, there was a feeling, I think, in some of the national media that because it was a pandemic, it affected all of us, and they were focusing just on the health consequences, which are the most tragic, obviously, that they forgot that they've got to keep the public figures who are in charge of this, both the politicians and the scientists and those who are running the administrations of Health and Human Services, also to task. And that means that I really think we need to say, what is the possibility of not having federal guidelines? If we do it state by state, it's almost certainly going to be a disaster, Rose, because this is a virus. This is a that doesn't respect the border between Nevada and California or Florida and Georgia. It doesn't care if you're Republican or Democrat. It doesn't care if you're an AOC booster or a Trump booster. It's an equal opportunity savager once it gets a hold and is able to replicate inside your body and attach to one of the receptors in your lungs. So that the virus is out there. We have done, even though the numbers you said before, a million and coming 70, over 70,000 dead on its way to 100,000, those numbers are grim, but they are better than they would be because we have been practicing social distancing. We have been staying largely inside and shut the economy down. If that had not been the case, they'd be much higher. So scientists I talk to daily say, look, the virus is there. It's waiting for us to come back out. And when we do, we will have to balance the weight between the increased number of infections and the death and reopening parts of the economy. That's a decision we'll have to make. But I think a lot of people don't think it's a decision. They think you can do one or the other. You can't. They go hand in hand.
Right. And we can completely understand people and their frustrations, their ability to make ends meet, the long lines that we're seeing at food banks. But when it comes to this, Gerald, it seems that people should be angry about the government response. The $1,200 check doesn't pay for much. A lot of people are still having a hard time getting their unemployment. Just today, I read that Senators Bernie Sanders, Kamala Harris, and Ed Markey are going to propose monthly payments of $2,000 during the pandemic. But this was needed months ago.
Yeah, it's remarkable. I think that we hear from the federal government the size of the overall amount, the tens of billions, the hundreds of billions of dollars involved. But what really happens is how ineffective it is. The payment to individuals, you're right, is such a modest and small amount. It makes no real difference in being able to put food on the table, paying the bills that you have, worrying about the rent coming forward, and all of the other pressing problems for those who are unemployed, which we know is at a record rate. In addition, when you look at what was the payroll protection program, the hundreds of billions of dollars meant for small businesses, and if you're running a flower shop, you're running a small coffee shop, you've got a shop where you're doing a landscaping and you've got three employees and you're able to keep one on because you get a loan from the government, that's fantastic. But when we all read about public corporations, large companies, companies earning millions of dollars, gaming the system in order to take the bulk of those billions away, it makes all of us infuriated, and we should be demanding more from our public and elected officials. We're not getting it.
Well, let's dive in. A lot of things have happened over the last couple of weeks. Let's first talk about this New York Times piece that came out on May 1st by Gina Colata, How Remdesivir, New Hope for COVID-19 Patients, Was Resurrected. She writes that the Food and Drug Administration issued an emergency approval for remdesivir. It's a treatment for patients severely ill with COVID. The story of remdesivir's rescue and transformation testifies to the powerful role played by federal funding, which allowed scientists laboring in obscurity to pursue basic research without obvious financial benefits. This research depends almost entirely on government grants. Give us some context behind this, Gerald.
Rose, this is one of the areas in which I think I get angrier than just about anything else. There are a lot of things that get me angry with, particularly about Big Pharma and the way that it operates and what it's doing through this pandemic. But remdesivir is one of those that it absolutely is a shining example of it. It's put out by a company called Gilead, which is not far from where you're broadcasting right now. You know, it's a 33-year-old biopharma company, I think, in Foster City. They have, and I talk about this in my book repeatedly, I have examples of them with HIV drugs and Hep C drugs. They have been very, very good over time at using public research, money that's funded by the taxpayer from the NIH or others, sometimes from private institutions like the Bill and Melinda Gates, to develop drugs that they then use and earn billions of dollars on. So, you know, they did this in the past when they came out with Sovata, which is a treatment for Hep C. It was $84,000 it was priced at. It was a sort of a pricing scandal in 2013. They did it with Truvada, which is a PrEP that came out that was a sort of with a prophylaxis that helped you slow the spread of AIDS, it was priced originally at $20,000. It was all federal money that went into it. As a matter of fact, Gilead didn't even believe in it. And they are now coming into remdesivir, which is also a product of public research and some public money, looking at it to try to cram it in here for treatment on COVID. And what the test has shown, by the way, it's gotten the Trump administration's been excited about this. They've been promoting it from sort of, you know, the beginning. They've been pushing it as one of the early advances, and they've approved it for emergency treatment and care right now. What it shows in this small little study is a three-day improvement in the time that a person stays in the hospital if they respond to the drug over a placebo. So instead of spending 14 days in, they get out on 11. So three-day improvement. And remember, it's an IV drug, so this isn't something that's going to be given out in a pill. But still, it's being pushed in at warp speed, and the real question is, what is the pricing going to be like? Because Gilead is looking for a hit, and I hate to say that in such a cold calculus when we're talking about lives, like you mentioned before, and the effect of this pandemic, but they used to earn $5 billion a quarter, by the way, just a sort of an astonishing price on their HIV drugs, on Truvada and that. That's down to about $700 million a quarter. They're looking for something to replace that, and that's why remdesivir, a possibility for a COVID treatment, is a dream come true possibly for Gilead.
Reuters reports that Wall Street analysts say remdesivir could generate $750 million or more in worldwide sales next year and $1 billion in 2022. But Gilead will need to avoid the appearance of taking advantage of a global health crisis to rake in profits.
Yeah, well, you know, so here's the interesting part, and we talked about this a little bit last time. Taking advantage of a public health crisis to rake in profits, that's what Big Pharma does. It's part of when you have a for-profit model on drug companies that are supposed to serve the public good, they aren't quasi-public trust. They aren't charities. They, in fact, look for opportunities, and an opportunity in this case is a public health crisis. There's nothing better than when governments are all coming together throwing money at research and people are desperate to get treatments because they are scared and panicked, and therefore you might be able to price it at a higher amount. But Gilead's walking a very fine tightrope here, and what I mean by that is they might, if they were just sitting down and able to price it at anything they wanted, come up with a price of $1,000 or $1,500 a pill or a treatment, and we would all be shocked, and they would almost get away with it. But in this case, I think the difficulty they have is they had already priced a previous pill at $1,000 when they came out with their with PrEP, and it got everybody crazy. So they're looking internally, my understanding is, at coming in under $1,000 a patient, believe it or not. That's a big thing for them, about $750 a patient. And if they're able to do that and give 200,000 of the treatments free for people in the United States, and also partner with Medicines Patents Pool, this UN-backed agency that licenses to generic drug makers in India and Pakistan to supply developing countries, Gilead is going to do a fine walk on the tightrope to sort of walk the line between saying we're doing enough for the public good, look at this in the third world, some free instances here in the U.S., and then price it an amount that doesn't pop your eyes out, over $1,000, and still bring in a couple of billion dollars a year. This is their DNA as they've done it before. I explained this in chapters on HIV and others on Hep C in the book, and you've sort of seen it play out here already on COVID-19.
What does the federal government get in return for pouring millions into research and testing?
That's the part that's so frustrating. And you know, the feedback that I've gotten so far from just lay people who have heard about the pharmaceutical industry or hear about Big Pharma, and then they read something in the book and I get an email from them, they will say, I cannot believe that we, meaning American taxpayers, are spending all this money, over $900 billion since the late 1930s, on research at the NIH, which the drug companies then take and put into these multi-billion dollar products, and none of it comes back for public research. None comes back to university. None goes into the NIH or reduces those budgets. It's remarkable to me that we've allowed them to get away with it. And we view this, it's so interesting, because I think that we've created a situation in the past on a number of these drugs where we have essentially allowed the drug companies to go ahead and sometimes they fought in court to get the rights to market this. I mean, Burroughs went to court to get the right to market the first AZT, the first drug against AIDS, HIV drug, AZT, when the government had done all the work, and they won that right because they own the underlying compound. In Truvada, Gilead is in court with the federal government making sure it has all the patent rights. So these drug companies sometimes don't get it voluntarily from the feds, but they win it in the end, and that's a shame. And by the way, for anyone listening who wants to know what the Gilead model will be, I'm predicting here that I think they will do, for those of you who have heard of Tamiflu, that's what they're really going to try to do here with COVID-19 and Remdesivir. Tamiflu has made a lot of money over time for the companies that have marketed. It's been a big hit for it, Roche, Hoffman LaRoche. It doesn't cure the disease, doesn't cure the flu. If you take it, it shortens the duration a little bit. At its peak, it brings in about $1 billion a year for Roche. But when flu outbreaks are high, severe, it goes to $5 billion a year. And it costs about $50 to $150 a treatment. So what Gilead hopes for, and this is not based upon conversations with anyone at Gilead, no one's talking to me there, I don't have a whistleblower inside, but from what I know how drug companies operate, they're hoping that COVID is a recurring event, meaning that there may be a vaccine for it, but it's not such an effective vaccine that 2 years down the road we say, oh, COVID's finished, that instead it becomes part of what we live with in the future. And that although the outbreaks may be less severe, they won't cause us to close down the economy, we'll still have occasional COVID-related outbreaks. It might mutate a little bit, 1 year worse than another, and they'll continue to sell Remdesivir from now to the end of time.
Mm. Well, Gerald, we're going to have to book you again to talk more about your book and Big Pharma lobbying, but I want to make sure that we haven't, and we're almost out of time, I want to make sure that we talk about two other big stories that happened this week. Dr. Rick Bright, the ousted director of the office involved in developing a coronavirus vaccine, filed an extensive whistleblower complaint on Tuesday. He is accusing the Trump administration of wrongdoing and funding potentially dangerous drugs by those with political connections. On a call with reporters after he filed his complaint, he said, quote, I was pressured to let politics and cronyism drive decisions over the opinions of the best scientists we have in government, end quote. Gerald, what stood out for you in this complaint, and what about media coverage?
Well, you know, I've seen a fair amount of media coverage on it, but not enough, I actually thought, because I'm biased on this. Granted, I'm a journalist. I like it when a government official finds that they are at a roadblock on something that's a critical issue that could affect lives. They can't get anywhere. They think they're being blocked and being squelched, and they turn to the only source they have, and that happens to be public dissemination through the press. That's exactly what Rick Bright did. You know, we're talking about somebody who was the director of Biomedical Advanced Research and Development Authority. It's an important position, and he was opposed to the chloroquine and hydroxychloroquine because he said it had lacked scientific merit. What was important to me in that whistleblower report was that one of his concerns was that the drugs were being imported from factories in India and Pakistan, which had no inspection by the FDA. And the other thing was that nothing that he provided to the journalists in the documents was privileged or classified. This is a classic case in which the powers that be in the administration did not like his message, which was slow the express train up. We're not sure if any of this works, and it's being distributed and ordered right now in record amounts and may actually harm people in the long run. And instead of allowing that dissenting voice to take place and have a hold in the decision-making, they forced him out into the public to talk to journalists, and then he gets sort of lambasted and pushed out on the side. I mean, these are the types of people that we should be saying thank you to. And I do say thank you to Dr. Bright, because I think that what he did was provide an important information to show us that we better be careful of what we're getting in the administration just being one-sided, you know, groupthink, and not hearing the dissenting voices.
He also said in his complaint that he raised urgent concerns about shortages of critical supplies like masks to his superiors in the Trump administration, but he was met with skepticism and surprise. He said some officials shared his concerns, including Trade Advisor Peter Navarro, but overall there was a lack of action at the very top.
Yeah, thank you, by the way, for reminding me of that very important part of the complaint, because I do think, look, there's no question, and you'll understand this, Rose, if you take the tens of thousands of people employed in federal service, and we were able to look at all the emails that were going back and forth inside Health and Human Services, I have no doubt that some well-placed people were raising concerns about PPE and masks and others beforehand. They just weren't able to be at a level high enough to be paid attention to. He was, and still people weren't paying attention to him. So Monday morning, we know where the problems are. We're looking back on Sunday, and we see that that was clearly a mistake. To the extent that they did not listen to him, Navarro, or others who were saying, by the way, we should be stockpiling this now. We're getting these numbers in big numbers. One of the things that I so dislike about what's happening here in the U.S., and I see it in Britain with Johnson, I see it with Macron in France, and that is the inability of governments to admit a mistake. You know what? This is a pandemic. It doesn't take place all the time. You get caught short sometimes after a generation of not having dealt with it. They aren't operating perfectly. So we would feel better, I think, in some ways, if our leaders could get up before us and say, by the way, we made a mistake on this. This was wrong. And if we were doing it again, we wouldn't do it that way. But they're incapable of doing that because they think it's going to be used against them for political advantage. They can't admit it. So we as journalists are the ones who have to point it out to them.
Gerald, what could come out of this whistleblower complaint by Dr. Rick Bright?
I think that Bright could well cause an investigation inside the House right now, where the only place that we're getting any talk about possibly investigations into pricing on Gilead or what happened in the early parts of the administration's response. Because the key here, it seems to me, is that period between January, when you have the Trump administration put the block on travel from China, and then March. We're missing a month. It's like you went to sleep and you woke up from a coma and you said, by the way, what month is it? You said March. You said, what happened to February? February passed by, and the administration was really, from all apparent purposes, everything that I can find and all the research that I can do, was very quiet, sort of lethargic, not moving ahead very fast. That's not to say there weren't people who were doing it, but as an overall response, they were sort of sitting and waiting, and that sitting and waiting was bad because guess what? The virus wasn't waiting. It was on its way through Europe and on its way to the U.S. and then from New York on its way as well across the country, even more than the West Coast spread that had first been in Washington. So I think that this whistleblower complaint will encourage others who right now are inside of government and may feel that they are being blocked, weren't listened to, or had information that was critically ignored to also eventually come out and help us provide an accurate history of what has transpired and where the government fell short in helping treat and save this public from this pandemic.
And one more story, and we only have about a minute or two left. The New York Times recently published a lengthy piece about how Jared Kushner brought in a number of inexperienced volunteers to identify vendors to buy PPE. A complaint filed with the House Oversight Committee alleges that these volunteers were pressed to prioritize requests from VIPs in conservative media. Volunteers were told to fast-track any queries from conservative media personalities sympathetic to Trump. And this is according to a complaint. Have you read this one, Gerald?
Yes, I have. As a matter of fact, it seemed to me it gave the Keystone Cops a good name. How could you put together a federally mandated a commission to be able to look into PPE? Not only do I believe from people that I have spoken to on this, and it's a story I've looked into, it was something based in my book. There had been a similar thing one time in the swine flu epidemic back in 76. We now have it playing out at a higher level inside here. With Kushner, how could it be possible to have been possibly gamed by some of the fake sales as well? I think this commission lost money, went down dead ends, and also wasted time on looking at what they thought were accumulating sales for or supplies for masks and other PPE that turned out to be bogus or were con jobs or people looking to fleece them for money, some of it political and some not. There's a story still to be told on that, and none of it's going to be very good for the Trump administration.
And we should say those volunteers were drawn from venture capital and private equity firms. They had absolutely no experience with healthcare or PPE. And I hope you can find that piece and read it over the weekend, how Kushner's volunteer force led a fumbling hunt for medical supplies.
Since they had no experience on doing it and they did a terrible job, maybe they'll be better the second time they do it, but I don't think they'll get that opportunity. It is remarkable that you would call on people with no experience in having done that beforehand. It's one of those things you shake your head at and say, how could that have been done? But it was.
Mm. Well, these stories need to be told. And Gerald, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us. And we are going to book you soon to talk about your latest book, Pharma, Greed, Lies, and Poisoning of America. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Rose. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Gerald Posner is an award-winning journalist, and you can find more about his work at yourcallradio.org. We did have Gerald on a past show to talk about vaccines, the cost, and who will have access to these vaccines. This is a really important question that still needs to be discussed. Thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance and Damian Miner for keeping our studio going. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.